piece called Heaven to Clear When Day Did Close. This is for alto, for tenor and string quartet. Have you ever heard that piece?
In an interview, you talked about it, and I tried to find a recording.
Yeah.
But it's okay. Kind of a lost one.
Well, no, there should be on my website. There should be that piece. I'd be surprised if it isn't there. The recording that exists was done by Ray Ricker at Eastman, and a graduate student string quartet at that time. And it's a good recording. And it's there. It's on an Eastman New Music, New American Music CD that was released some years ago. So that piece for tenor turned out well. I like the tenor a lot in that way. I've written most for alto in solo pieces. Like the alto voice a lot. Soprano has its place in the context of the quartet pieces. It has its particular voice. I like the sound of the soprano a lot. It opens something special. So,
do you like the sound of the soprano in the context of the quartet?
Or I do. And I do. And I've used the soprano. There are a number of places where the solo, soprano solo happens in the wind ensemble pieces. One of the happiest is in the Traveler piece at the very end. There's a unison line for flute and soprano saxophone, which is extremely difficult to produce, but wonderful when it happens. Yeah. So context is all. You know, I can't say categorically I like this, I don't like that.
Sure. As a composer, I know you emphasize the importance of the performer discovering their own connections with the music. But has there been any musicians that you've had a particularly strong bond with playing your music, and why is that?
Oh gosh, there's so many. The question now reads that I have a strong bond with the people who have played the music. Is that the case? Is that what you imply?
Strong bond. Musically, I guess is kind of... I guess what I'm looking for is what artists have a... that you find to be very well adapted to tapping into your musical flow and your music.
Oh, okay. Well, there have been any number of people. There are two ways of thinking. There are those people who intuitively get it and who open on their own to it. And then there are the people who grow into it. In terms of conductors, let's start there. My friend Steele that I've mentioned, his was a long, slow growth process. He was at heart a technician. He was able to make a band sound good. And to find the actual heat of the music was another issue for him. But over a long period of time, but he intuited that there was something in my music that he needed, and he persisted with it and kept going, and continued to make discoveries, and I continued to work with him. So we had an ongoing sense of this discovery process, and eventually he began to ask me to compose pieces, and so we began making things together. Let's take two examples of, maybe three examples of saxophone players, and Joe Luloff is one. He is an immediate, intuitive player. And he simply has a grasp of what's in front of him, and he goes into that other space. You know, so his conscious presence is one thing, his musical presence is this other space that happens, and he goes into it, and he's fully gone. And so there's very little I have to say to Joe about what needs to be done in the music. And so he can find it. There's a bond that takes place there. This other person that we've talked about, Otis Murphy. Otis also performed the saxophone concerto, and I was there. This is a long time ago now, 10 years or so, longer, at Indiana. And when I first worked with Otis, he's a wonderful player, but he was trying to be very good. He was trying to be a nice person and a nice player and do the music nicely and so on and so on. And it wasn't working. So I finally essentially told him to be yourself and play this thing. And he was able to open up into it in a very broad way. A more dramatic change was with Paul Nolan. Paul had studied with Luloff and had told me, he said that given Joe's performance mannerisms and his way of being, which is this kind of effusive, demonstrative way of playing, Paul was, he said, in a word, put off by that. Said, well, that's not me, I'm not doing that. And became a very refined player with a very specific idea of what tone should be on the saxophone, and with its within that limitations. We got into a performance of the concerto, and we're going to do a recording at Illinois State with Paul and Steve Steele. And we got into rehearsal on the piece. So we're going to have a performance. We had, I think, probably two rehearsals set up. There's going to be a performance and there's going to be a recording session. And we got into the first rehearsal, and the limitations of his sound were present. He could only go so far in the expressive quality and particularly in the dynamic quality. Now, you have in your playing a real immediate grasp of the intensity edge of things that are very, very powerful. Paul was restrained in that regard. And I simply worked with him during rehearsal and said, this has to open in a very different way. And he allowed it, he worked on it, he thought about it. We did as best we could in rehearsal. He went away. 2 days later, he came back a transformed player. He just simply opened something in himself, said, okay, all right, this other thing has to happen. Here it is. Yeah. It suddenly turned powerful. And he looks back, I think, at that time and says that was a radical change moment for him to be able to let himself find that element. Further saxophone players. The Japanese group, the Masato Kumoi Quartet, they've been together. Three of them went to two of them went to Northwestern University. Kumoi was actually in the wind ensemble that did the premiere performance of A Child's Garden of Dreams, and this was 1983, I think it was. Yeah. So he's a guy now in his upper 50s. And that quartet has probably been together for 20 years, the same membership. They first became aware of them because they sent me a CD of a performance of Mountain Roads. I had not heard of them. I didn't know anything about them. I received a CD in the mail. And often when that's the case, it's like, who knows what this is? And I said, okay, I'll listen. I listened. It was fabulous. It was a wonderful performance of the piece. So I was in touch with them and complimented them on it very highly. And that turned into a commission for a new piece, which became the recitation book. And I began to hear in their playing the capacity for that ensemble to be a unified sound. So these players, especially in the tenor and barre area, had the capacity to play their instruments in a way which was a uniform blend with the upper instruments. Normally, you've got soprano, alto, and then these other two, which present a kind of a struggle issue for the ensemble. You know, in the same way that you say you struggle with the low register of your alto. I mean, well, tenor and barre can be just frankly awful in ensemble sound. So the recitation book piece got written with the idea that they don't have to be awful. In fact, they need to be otherwise. And then the further pieces, the songs for the coming day, written specifically with the knowledge that these players could do this, that the tenor and barre players could produce a sound which would be a coherent blend with the soprano alto, so a unified ensemble sound, and the requirement that that should be the case. And these players came up to that requirement. So that development of their capacity refined to that much greater degree. Other players, probably one of my closest musical friends is a woman named Kim Reisinger, who is on the faculty at Illinois State. I've known her for over 20 years. She did her master's degree at Illinois State, and then she went off and played in a military band and did a doctorate at University of Delaware or something of that sort, and then eventually got the job as a flute instructor at Illinois State. She is an amazing natural musician. She has without any prompting from me, she has this capacity to go into a piece of music and with whatever process she does, deeply into it, every quality and every character, what needs to happen in that music. And she has the capacity to open herself fully to what has to happen through her. She is a lovely person as a person. She's a normal person in most regards, you know. You wouldn't necessarily guess this quality of musical talent just by looking at her or talking to her. She's otherwise a lovely, normal person. And when she plays a flute, it goes into this other place. She has recorded a lot of my music. The songbook for flute and wind ensemble. Do you know that piece by any chance? Okay, and so if you have a recording, it probably is hers. And then she recorded my duo for flute and piano, and this is a piece which is fiercely difficult, especially for the piano. It was written in 1972. Hard piece. If you don't know it, go take a look at that. It is a powerful piece, but it the performance requirement is extreme. She, in her process of making recording of all my flute music, she came to this piece and began working it up with her pianist. Who agreed, and then once she got into it, I said, oh my God, you know, what have I done? But persisted, and she got it together. We did a recording session on that piece. The piece is, I think, 21 minutes in duration. The recording session lasted 27 minutes. It was a flat-out read of the piece, and we finished the read, and we went, oh. Yeah, there was nothing to... And we picked out a couple of things for a couple of minutes, said, yeah, this is it. There's no need to go any further with that. Yeah. And that stands. That's an amazing recording, and that's available to anybody who wants to hear it. Well, okay, I can go on with any number of people, but maybe that,
I think that's good.
Satisfies what you had in mind. Yeah.
Actually, I think I'll jump to the Kumoi question that I had then. I must have changed it. Is there an ideal, quote unquote, way you like to perform your music? Before performances, I've seen where you attend, you take a moment to talk about the work and its significance of music and of music in society. Is there something you would like others to do when performing your works?
Oh, get it right. Not being facetious, I think. The fundamental is, as we have begun to working on it over these couple of days, and always I come back to the capacity actually to see what's on the page, and the inner capacity to allow yourself to go there. That's the requirement. I don't care if people talk about the music or what they have to say, it doesn't matter. But this other, and I think you understand it perfectly well, that every mental space is different, and people bring so many stories to the music making. The process of becoming a really good performer is sorting out your personal stories and realizing that you have them. And then allowing the music to move the way it wants to, regardless of your personal story. What I see time and time and time again in performances is that, first off, people don't actually see what's on the page in terms of tempo and dynamics. They will make adjustments. I just had an experience this past spring with an ensemble that was playing... Fourth Symphony, I believe it was. Fourth Symphony on the concert, but the piece that they were, there was a second ensemble that was playing Give Us This Day. And the conductor got into the second movement, and the tempo was substantially below what was written on the page. I simply said, well, what's happening? And he said, well, in his estimation, this was the tempo at which they could do it without making too many mistakes. And this was their maximum to have some kind of clean performance. But he knew what the tempo was supposed to be, but he told himself the story that his band couldn't do it. And so I said, no. We're not going to do that. Politely, of course. And they said, well, let's place it at the written tempo and begin to see what happens. And so we did. And within minutes, you know, the band is playing at the right tempo and playing with an excitement and an enthusiasm, which they did not have for the other because it was wrong. You know? But he had made that intellectual choice. He said, my band can't, so I won't. And that I run into all the time. Either the person isn't able to open fully to the experiment of tempo or dynamics or expressive value, or believes that their band or their ensemble or that they, and for whatever reason, cannot do So that's the fundamental, is continually asking people to open fully to what's printed on the page and to open fully to the experiment of how you do that.
Active imagination is a very personal thing. Can you describe how you came to it and what process you discovered?
Well, okay, we already talked about that to some extent. It had to do initially with that experience that I described of working on a vocal piece in which I was concentrated on the text and had this experience of my mind opening and sort of a circle right in the middle of my forehead, and of seeing a vision of something which seemed very alive and very real. And then recognizing that as a kind of special experience that I didn't know anything about. I want to say, though, about active imagining, that whether one uses this or not, or has any conception of it or not, there are many fine composers and fine artists of all stripes who do not conceive of the world in these terms. For whom it might be a total mystery. But what happens to a person who is organized as a composer is that stuff pushes at you and you find a way to deal with it. So as a young composer, that's all I could say, the best I could say. Things pushed at me and I was required by the push to find a way to satisfy that, to find the notation that would satisfy that. So stuff was coming up through me, and it was coming out onto notation, and that's the best I could say as a composer. I began to discover this quality, that there was another quality of mind that I didn't know about, but which was operating. A quality which I think was operating in any case, it just now began to come into consciousness. So let's put it that way. Good artists are those who can allow the deep impulses to come forward in them in whatever way it happens for them. And this is composers, this is creative artists in the sense of making something, and it's also performing artists. Now, I don't think, for instance, Joe Luloff articulates his sense of musical expression in these terms at all. I don't believe that's the case. Right? He simply does it. Right? It has come to me to have it as an experience and then to begin to articulate what that experience is. When the Child's Garden piece began to show up, that is, the dreams came to my attention, I decided that I would make a conscious effort to look at those dreams in the same way that this other experience had happened to me. And that opened my conscious way of going more deeply into the dream space. Around that time, with these experiences, I began another set of explorations, one of them having to do with tarot cards, and the other having to do with beginnings of practicing shamanic practice, just the very beginnings of it. And with those two, I can tell you something about tarot cards, for instance. The images on tarot cards, so let's talk about the reality. People would think, well, tarot card reading is kind of bogus, whatever. it is not. What it can do, what tarot cards can do, is to provide a stimulus to the reader's unconscious mind, a stimulus which opens a quality of the person in front of them, opens that immediately into the reader's mind. And what I discovered was that I never became fluent in actually reading these cards, but I came to a point of understanding that I could feel the energy of the cards. I could feel the energy of the question that was being asked, or the question that was being explicated by the cards. I could feel the energy. I could feel the quality of it. I could feel the dream space that was part of it. So it gave me that sense of a kind of confidence in the movement that I was feeling in myself. The shamanic work has to do with focusing conscious attention on movement into a tunnel which would go down and then arrive out in another space. And we've begun that little bit of practice in meditation. So I simply began exploring these various paths and at a certain point said, can I do this tunnel thing while I'm walking? Because I'd already taken up walking for the sake of exercise. And I said, okay, let's give it a try. And I went out, started walking, and began to allow my mind to find the tunnel space and to move into it. I found that I could do it. I found that it was simple by experiment, very conducive to me to walk and to allow the mind to move into this other space. Oh, the rest of it was just sheer interest and continuous exploration. So I did this for years and have continued doing it for, spent close on now to 40 years of this kind of work. Is there something I'm missing in your question?
No, okay. That covers a lot. Okay. So in the original manuscript for the concerto, in the third movement, there are no rests in the 32nd note section, but the
yes.
newer editions there are.
Yeah.
Was this a performer edit?
For the sake of making it more possible, it's just a demanding passage, and you know how demanding it is.
Yeah.
And so the original version was even more so. It seemed to me, hearing the effort that Joe Lulav was making, that it was just too much. I edited it to this other. My son Matthew, however, is of the opposite opinion. He's saying you should go back to the original. He said, yeah, it's hard, but people will grow into it. And I'm of a mixed mind about that. Yeah. What do you think of that passage as a player?
It is one of the most challenging pieces of technique I've ever encountered.
Yeah.
But in many ways, I also find it to be easy because it is a very strong and singular emotion that it is trying to convey.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is exactly a good mindset, but at a certain point, it is... At a certain point, the notes tend to lose their significance, and the sensation behind the line is really what's important to convey.
Yeah. Now, when you say the notes lose their significance, tell me more what you think about that. I understand it, but tell me what you think.
At least from my perspective, while every day it's an attempt to try to make it as accurate as possible... I think as long as the quality of the quality of the music is so present and what is trying to be conveyed, that missing a note here or cracking one slight note within this multitude of notes becomes less and less significant as long
Correct.
As the nature of the music is present.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So you've crossed that line into allowing the music to be fully what it wants to be. And for you, the realization is there of the technical requirement, but that's not the end of it. The technical requirement opens the musical space. It is so interesting to me that technical yes, all music has a technical basis and you have to be able to play. But the heat can come through regardless. And one of the happier experiences I've had, any number, with younger bands in particular, but say the premiere performance of Hell's Gate, this piece was written for the Hellgate High School Band here in Missoula, and they had some excellent saxophonists at that time. And this is 1990, I want to say 97, when it was premiered, so it's been that long. the conductor, John Combs, would never have chosen this piece for his band on his own, because he would have seen it as too difficult. I wrote it, having heard his band and having understood in my imagination that the band could play it. John respected that and took up the piece, worked diligently at it, and produced a premiere performance which I would describe as hot and messy. It's not what you want to hear on recording because it's messy. But the heat was immediately present in the room. It was a glorious premiere performance. So there was the basic minimum requirement of technique was there with gaps and whatever problems. And yet the music was able to find its way. My wife has a very keen ear for music, and she's been aware for a very long time. She said that it doesn't really matter what people do to your music, the music will sound. Yeah, so there's that. I do trust that.
Now, on the topic of the fire and making sure the energy is present, is this something that you've had to encounter in terms of the perfection, in terms of the recording process, when you're trying to reach a certain level of perfection versus having the natural energy of the music present?
Oh, gosh. What is perfection? Perfection, can we say that perfection is that every single note is exactly in place and so on? And some people will count that as the quality of perfection. There are any number of people who do recording, you know, two measures at a time. You know, we'll get this right, we'll get this right, we'll get this right, we'll get this right, and we'll tack it all together and we'll have the perfect performance. I have never done recording in those terms. All my recording is living energy. So recording process, say for a multi-movement piece like the concerto, read the entire first movement, no stops. Talk about stuff, maybe practice a spot or two, maybe read a spot or two, read the entire movement again. Adjustment. Read the entire movement a third time. That's it. Yeah. End of game. And in that will be the full heat of the music and the technical aspect of it will be there at a high level without being fussy about this absolute kind of stuff. Yeah. As soon as you get to that fussiness of thinking that you can control every detail of the situation, you know, every person has a microphone and there's a soundboard with thousands of adjustments and editing processes, somebody tweaking this and pushing that and so on, you turn into something which is not music anymore. I always need to have the clear musical process at work and people in a frame of mind to be able to actually play musically. If you do the other, you turn into people into fatigue and depression and demoralization, and you can only go a certain far distance for that.
Related to the recording process, then, Mr. Jordheim had a lot of influence in bringing the sonata to public appearance. Could you talk a little bit about interacting with him and his experience with that and the recording process that you were a part of, correct?
Mm-hmm. Do you know him?
No.
By any event? Well, he's now, probably toward the end of his teaching career. He was present at the very first performance of the sonata, which was under very curious circumstances. The piece was commissioned by the North American Saxophone Alliance as a contest piece for the 1989 convention, I guess it was, and that was going to be in Virginia. And this is not a good contest piece. I mean, it's too hard and too demanding. What happened is that they had hired a pianist to be the pianist for the people who were going to play the solo parts. And this guy was only sort of prepared, so out of all that, we did pick a person who was declared the winner of the competition, and that person got to do the premiere performance, did as best they could. But it was so interesting because the way they placed it in the convention, the afternoon had been devoted to jazz ensembles, and there was supposed to be a point at which the jazz ensembles finished, and then there would be the announcement of this competition, and then the award to the winner, and then the performance of the piece. Well, the jazz the end of it went over significantly, like an hour over, and it butted up against dinner time. And it was 5 o'clock, the jazz thing finished. Everybody got up and left. And so just a few people remained, and maybe 20 people came in or stayed and actually heard this premiere performance of the piece. One of them was our friend. Who are we talking about?
Yes, Mr. Jordan.
Steve Jordan. I'm sorry, I just blanked on the name.
It's okay, I blanked for a second, too.
Okay, and so Steve was there, and he just simply said yes to this piece, and he took it up and began to play it. Steve is an extremely modest guy, for the longest time, he did not want to make a recording, because he said, well, essentially, who am I to make a recording to present to people? And I essentially said to him, if not you, then who? you play this piece, and you play it awfully well. And so that was my encouragement to him, and he went ahead and did the recording. Steve is one of those players who is, I think even in spite of the personality, which is extremely self-effacing and modest, that kind of man. But when he enters into music making, it opens up fully. He was able to do that with the piece. And I recall his pianist, there were two people that were involved in this case. But the person who actually made the recording is a woman, I don't remember her name anymore. But they simply played powerfully and wonderfully. So Steve did the work to set the piece on its feet. And it took actually quite a while for the sonata to make its way out and to become part of a general awareness. And so it's been a long haul.
I think I know the answer to this question, but what advice would you give to musicians working with collaborators on your music that are not predisposed to the frame of mind of your music?
Oh, wow.
Or if anything, are almost turned off.
Well, if that's the case, then they won't be dealing with the music.
Sure.
There are all manner of people. I appreciate it when people like my music, but I also realize that there are people who don't deal with it and don't like it and don't want to go that way. There are several conductors, in fact, a fair number of conductors that I know who simply don't play the music. And that's okay. And so the people who do play the music are self-selecting. That is, they understand that they want to get into it, and they go ahead, they start working on it. And those who can contact me have already worked at a high level to get the music up. And so there isn't this quality of antipathy or resistance. There's only one case that I can remember out of all the times that I've worked with people, no, two cases, where I've gone to a place and a conductor has essentially tried to keep me away from their ensemble. And they invited me for reasons they thought they should. Somebody suggested to them that this would be a good thing to do. They did. And then when they got there, they discovered that they really didn't want me looking at them. Yeah. And so, but just two out of the hundreds that I worked at. So it's probably the best I can say is that the people are self-selecting, and if they select to do the music, then they have already made a very highly positive motion toward being able to do it right. So that thought arises that if you say you can do it, then yes, you can.
I was reading an interview that you had with a man I cannot remember the name of at the time. I think he was writing a dissertation on Symphony No. 3 at Miami. But
okay,
he described something called the Harner Book.
Yes, okay. That would be Brent. All right, his name will come.
I think his first name is starting with an A.
Starting A?
But
okay.
I'm not sure.
It'll come to me. The Michael Harner book is a basic text on shamanic practice. It's a book that I was recommended to many years ago back when living in New York. And the book is called The Way of the Shaman. Harner was an anthropologist. I don't believe he's still alive. If he is, he's a very old man. As a young man, he went to South America and became involved with a native group of people who were had shamanic practice as one of the foundations of their life. And he started out simply by studying this and then became involved with it as a participant. And so that changed from being, you know, the observer into being the thing itself. And he began to discover its potential to realize that a lot of it had been blotted out by both more modern religious teachings such as Christianity, which looks really askance at such practices, and by governmental things. So one of the root points of shamanism in the world is in the area of Siberia, actually, and in that part of the world, and it was seriously disrupted by communist state. So that practice, though, had come down through native peoples coming across to the Americas and had found its way through native cultures. And there's also a European variety of shamanism. So Harner's realization began to be that every culture had at some point a contact with this art and evolved it away. And it has a lot to do with what we've been talking about, a lot to do with what Jung has to say about the nature of the unconscious, the nature of the archetypal level of the unconscious, which is a universal among people. It has nothing to do with culture. It simply is one of the foundations for being human. But Harner began to tap into this practice and to develop it in himself, and then to realize that a life path for himself would be to begin to revive shamanic practice in the Western world. And so he had developed an organization, which still exists, that teaches the shamanic practice. And so you can go and actually take courses in this. I've taken a basic course, just one, my wife as well, and just in the discovery of the fundamentals of it. And then I took that and began to apply it in my own terms and what I've done myself. So that book was important for me. That, along with the Carl Jung, Man and His Symbols, and also the Jung book that he wrote as an autobiography called Memories, Awesome. Dreams, Reflections. So
I have one last question.
Okay.
In the piano part of the saxophone sonata, on the third movement, at the part where notation ceases to really, at the part where notation kind of breaks down and it becomes screams, it says, remembering Barney Childs is on the edge of the world.
Yeah. Do you know Barney Childs as a composer at all?
No.
Was a California composer. He taught at University of Redlands. He was born, I think, probably in the late 1920s. He lived about 70 years, so he died in the late 90s. And he was a mentor to many young composers, so people that went through. He was a dedicated modernist. His practice in music was toward the experimental in terms of performer freedom, structural freedom of all kinds. And you might look him up see what you can find in terms of his music. I became acquainted with him when I went to the McDowell Colony for the first time. This was in 1974. And he was there, he heard my music and was very impressed and sympathetic with what he'd heard of mine. Said in effect, you know, I was at that age 28, and he said in effect, I'd be curious to see what your music is like in 20 years. So he already had that sense that something was interesting for him in my music. We were very different composers. I was writing, you know, a music which had this kind of expansive narrative quality in the old way, and his was very, very different. He and I became friends. He was a very strong mentor for me when I was going through some very difficult times. He was the person who offered me my first commission, actually, music for clarinet and piano. He had a duo that he played with out in Redlands. Among many pieces of his, one is called The Edge of the World. It is for bass, clarinet, and organ. one of the pieces of his that I really like, and there are sounds in there which are just this wailing overtone kind of qualities which you can get on the bass clarinet, and that struck me, stayed in my mind. And the piece that I wrote for tenor sax and string quartet, Heaven to Clear, One Day to Close, is a line from a poem by Barney Giles. And the foundation of the piece is a quotation from a piece by Barney Giles. And essentially, the piece itself is a fantasia on that quotation. Barney Giles was not a great composer. I went back a few years ago and dug out a recording, in fact, came across it, of his music. And I listened to it and I said, this is awful stuff. you know, it's just this mid-century modernism, which just, like, really? So, sorry, Barney, wherever you are. Yeah, you're a good man, and he did very, very good things for me.
So, should the performer listen to this and try to emulate
sure.
effects of it?
Yeah, go listen. Yeah, and that's an odd passage, and you have to make your way. Different people do it different ways, and I just sort of hear and respect what people try to do. Some are very neat about it, and some are very blatant, and so. I don't know. I'm not going to dictate what it's supposed to be. Yeah.
Sure. And I guess that kind of answers this, but do you, like, I understand that the piano is basically playing the same repetitive four notes continually and kind of setting this mood, and you have it dictated somewhat in time.
Yeah.
Should it be performed in time?
No.
Some performers have extended it and kind of lose sense of time in that perspective?
Yeah. No, the... What measure number?
301.
301. Yeah, no, this is all strict in the piano. Absolutely. Has to be.
Okay.
Yeah. If you break it, then you let go of the attitude. So, no, strict. And the saxophone is off in its own world.
So strictly in time, as well as like keeping within, like, this should be performed with the first screech as one bar, second one is two bars.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it's written specifically in time.
Okay.
And there isn't anything else to say about it.
Okay. And then, sorry, this reminded me of one last question.
Okay.
So, if you didn't have a singular person in terms of commission for the, because the sonata was a competition piece,
that's right,
quote unquote,
yeah,
and the concerto was not with a specific person in mind,
yeah,
what kind of energy did you meditate on
to
get these inspirations?
Yeah, and I can say with this piece, which is early enough in the meditative work, I don't know if I can answer this question adequately. The best I can say about it is that the piece arose, and I don't have specific images that I can put on it right now for you. It is just that far back that I'm not able to give you specific pictures.
And for the concerto?
And I'm going to have to say the same for that too. You know, it's hard for me to say it out. It's in a certain way, I don't want to say it out. There is a huge amount of inner work that goes on with each piece of music. So much so that I really don't want to talk about it. The concerto is one of those pieces. It is a full life story, and even bigger than that. The imagery surrounding it for me is still very intense, and even though it doesn't have a very specific person associated that is with a complete focus on it, but the piece of music itself was one of those that showed up in a bright intensity that I simply had to follow. Maybe that's not, I don't even know if that makes any sense, but each piece of music is that way, that it will start with a meditative process, and then the evolution of that, what I would call that bright intensity, happens, and my requirement to follow that until it is satisfied musically. So what I think I'm avoiding is the idea of an explanation of these pieces. There's going to be more coming about this. My son Matthew has asked me to, rather persistently, to begin to write about this whole experience, the whole composition process, and I have started to do this. So over time, over the next few years, I hope to be able to produce some thoughtful responses. I don't know. I have some inclination toward it, and a whole lot of inclination just to keep writing music. Yeah. So maybe I think that's the best I can say on it right now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. And I appreciate the fact that you're so interested in this. Yeah.